Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
On To the Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To the Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To the Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From this cradle of the Confederacy, this very heart of the great Anglo-Saxon Southland, let us rise to the call of freedom-loving blood that is in us and send our answer to the tyranny that clanks its chains upon the South. In the name of the greatest people that have ever trod this earth, I draw the line in the dust and toss the gauntlet before the feet of tyranny. And I say segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever.
Alabama Governor George Wallace speaking at his inauguration in 1963. The next year, in 64, he ran for president as a Democrat. But when he planned to run again in 1968, the Democrats rejected his segregationist platform. So a new ultra-conservative party was created here in California to put Governor Wallace on the ballot. It was called the American Independent Party. It still exists. In fact, it boasts more registered voters than all the other small parties combined. The problem is most of its members joined the party by mistake. That's according to an investigation carried out by the LA Times. And here to tell us more is John Myers, the Times Sacramento Bureau Chief. Hi, John.
Hello.
How many California voters are registered as members of the American Independent Party?
Well, a lot, Madeline, at least in third-party terms. About 478,000, which is absolutely dwarfed by Democrats, Republicans, and people who actually are independents, nonpartisan voters. Totally, there are more of them than there are American Independent Party voters. But when you look at the Green Party, Libertarian, Peace and Freedom, they are nowhere near the American Independent Party. And that registration has grown over years. As a matter of fact, we have, in our analysis, we kind of tracked it along with those true nonpartisan voters, and they have both risen at pretty equal levels through the years.
And they've risen because of confusion over how to register, mainly?
Yeah, that's what we think. I mean, we conducted a poll of American Independent Party voters, so people who are registered with that party. Democratic pollster, Republican pollster, all done pro bono. We at the Times crafted the questions. And we asked, the first question we asked is, are you registered with a party? 73% of the people said, no, I'm not registered with a party. Even all of them are registered with a party, though. They're all AIPs, American Independent Party. And then after that, very few could identify the American Independent Party as what was on their registration card. So if you extrapolate that, that could be, more than 300,000 Californians have no idea they're in this party, that they could be there simply by mistake.
And then when you actually delve deeper and read them the platform of the American Independent Party, then some of them got a little concerned?
Yeah, I mean, the platform, if you look at this party's platform, it's vague in particular places, like it says, you know, we believe in freedom and things like that. But then in its specific areas, the party is against abortion rights. The party is against same-sex marriage. When you read those platform issues, specifically the same-sex marriage one, because that's one where their language is most clear, you found a pretty healthy dose. Above 40% of the people that we polled said they disagreed with the party on that issue. And then at the end of the poll, we asked people, now that you know about the party, do you want to stay in it or leave? And about 50% of the people in the poll said, I want to leave the American Independent Party, which, again, I think, you know, speaks to this issue that they did not know they were in a formal party. They thought they were a lowercase I independent, and they're not.
And you found some celebrities and big names were on this list, too.
Yeah, we went through the list. We took we took the whole pile of American Independent voters, Public Records Act requests from the state, and we searched through to kind of see who they were. And we found some celebrities, actress Demi Moore, actress Emma Stone, boxing legend Sugar Ray Leonard, all registered with the American Independent Party. Ultimately, folks near them came back and said, it's a mistake. They're changing their registration. But we also found a lot of people across California, Madeline, who had made the mistake. And what I took from this reporting project is that there is no one subset of Californians who have made the mistake about thinking they were independent more than anybody else. It cuts across race and region, and whether you're an average Joe or a celebrity, you could have made the mistake.
Okay, so tell us exactly how that's made. When you decide to register, you want to be an independent, small I, how do you do it?
Well, and in a follow-up story that we published this morning, you know, a lot of the questions come down to that voter registration card, where you make that choice. The card currently says, do you wish to disclose a party preference? And you have to say, no, I do not wish to disclose a party preference. That is truly being an independent. Otherwise, you look on the other side of the card, and the very first name you see is American Independent Party. And then some of the people we talked to, they said, well, I saw that. I'm an American. I'm an independent. I want that. And they didn't realize it was a party. I mean, it is important to point out that the vast majority of people who want to be unaffiliated, lowercase I independent, they succeed in doing it. There are several million of them in California. But there is this pretty healthy subset, as our reporting found, that have made that mistake and picked the wrong thing on the form.
Yeah, 3% of the registered voters in California. Well, is there still time to unregister by the June primary? Okay.
Yeah, one of the reasons we wanted to get this into print and get it out there for folks early, and they can go online, they can check their status on the database that we put up on the website, is that you have until May 23rd to either register or make changes to your registration. So you've got a little more than a month. And I think we're going to be curious to see how many people log on and realize they made a mistake and re-register. Because that's important, if I can point out really quickly. Mm-hmm. In the Democratic presidential primary in California, you can cast a ballot if you are a true independent. You can vote Clinton or Sanders. You cannot do that, however, if you're in the American Independent Party. And I think there would be some voters who would be very disappointed if they wanted to vote in that primary and found out they weren't really an independent. Republicans have a closed primary, no options there, but Democrats will allow true independents to cast a ballot. So people who had an interest in that would want to check that out.
Okay. So true independents, how many of them are there now? You said that the rolls have been increasing in recent years.
It's one of the fastest growing designations in California. About one out of every four registered voters in the state is now unaffiliated with a party. More and more people, we're seeing it more through younger Californians especially, don't have that desire to join a political party the same way that their parents did. So it's a very fast-growing population, and I think one of the reasons that we saw this, and people who work in politics have seen it, is, again, the American Independent Party size has grown at about the same kind of pace, which made you wonder whether all those people were there because they intended to or because they were trying to become unaffiliated independent voters.
Well, what does the American Independent Party say about this?
Well, it depends. I've talked to their leadership a couple of times over the course of the reporting project. The bottom line is they said they don't want people to be there by mistake. If you don't want to be part of their party, don't be part of their party. They did disagree that the problem was as widespread as we had found in our poll. They think that more people are there intentionally. But again, you know, they also think that people should be where they want to be. And I think that's the real message out of all of this, is that people should check out their voter registration. You know, the database we built at LATimes.com has the ability to check if you are a true independent or an American independent. And as we said, you can clear that up in a matter of clicks and re-register yourself to vote.
John Meyer, Sacramento Bureau Chief of the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Well, we want to know if this has happened to you, if you are an independent voter and maybe you checked the American Independent Party box on your voter reg card. Give us a call at 1-844-PRESSPLAY or reach out on Twitter or Facebook at KCRW Press Play. It sounds ideal. Learn from home at your own pace with one-on-one instruction, just you and your computer and your virtual teacher. Well, thousands of K-12 students in California now go to online schools. California Virtual Academies is the state's largest network of online charter schools with 15,000 students.
The curriculum isn't geared to just the average student in the classroom. It could be the student who's at the top, who's an advanced learner, or the student who needs assistance to get up to average. The program allows you to work with your student right where they are to help them to achieve their potential in all of their courses.
They're public schools funded by tax dollars, but the San Jose Mercury News reports that California Virtual Academies is actually run by a for-profit company called K-12, which is based in Virginia. The paper reports K-12 has reaped millions in public school funding by hiding behind a nonprofit status. The story also finds that California Virtual Academies is failing many of its students. Fewer than half who enroll earn diplomas. At K-12 stockholder meeting last December, its own investors criticized the school's academic performance. Jessica Calafati reported the story. She's capital correspondent for the Mercury News. Welcome.
Thank you.
So tell us exactly what happens in online schooling. How many kids in the state attend these schools, and how do they do their work? How do they learn?
So more than 15,000 students are enrolled in schools that are managed by K-12 Inc., and the way it works is a teacher will boot up their computer from home, a student will boot up their computer from home, and both parties will sign on and connect over the internet. Students can hear teachers' voices, but they can't even see them on a video feed.
And they're given assignments, homework, one-on-one instruction?
Yes, in some cases. So for many students, they're invited to participate in a live class session, but our reporting found that many students do not take advantage of that opportunity. And in many cases, students do not watch the lessons that are recorded. So students are able to do work on their own, which in theory sounds like a great idea, lots of flexibility for students and for parents. But in many cases, students don't do the work on their own, and there's limited accountability to make sure that they're on track.
So California Virtual Academies is not hiding the fact that it is associated with a for-profit company. K-12, the website, says that. But is it illegal for a for-profit to run a charter school or a charter network?
So California law is silent on whether for-profit companies are allowed to run charter schools. There are other states that have banned for-profit companies from operating charter schools, but our state is not one of them. So in this gray area, the company has set up operations.
Can you talk a little bit more about the relationship between K-12 and California Virtual Academies? What is the financial relationship between the two of them?
So each California Virtual Academy holds a contract with the company that explains the company's responsibilities, which include writing the school's budget, hiring its teachers, picking its administrators, and much more. And in exchange, the schools are required to pay up to 75% of their state aid to the company. But because the company's rates exceed what the schools can afford, the company ends up paying about 50% of their revenue to the company.
So K-12 is really running these schools? And this is a for-profit company. It's listed on the stock exchange.
That's right. It's a for-profit company based in Virginia running schools for California students.
So who is holding these schools accountable for their students' performance?
The schools are supposed to be held accountable by the local school districts that authorize them, but we also found that there is limited accountability at that level and almost no accountability at the state level. We found that many of the authorizing districts that are supposed to be looking after these schools are confused about what their responsibilities entail, and in some cases, the authorizers are choosing not to do more. And we found that they have an incentive because they're paid a portion of the state aid that these online schools get to educate their students. So the authorizers have an incentive to be lax in their oversight responsibilities because they get paid regardless of how well the students do in school. So we found one example where there's a very, very small district in San Diego with only 35 students, and they're responsible for overseeing an online charter school, one of the schools in this network that has more than 3,000 students. So you can imagine how much state money you get for overseeing 3,000 students when your own district only has 35.
Hmm, I see. Well, what about in larger districts? I mean, there are a few here in Los Angeles.
That's right. So in Los Angeles, for example, the West Covina Unified School District is the overseer of the California Virtual Academy at Los Angeles. And in most cases, the West Covina Unified School District is paid $1 million a year to oversee the California Virtual Academy at Los Angeles.
And as you say, there's not a lot of oversight happening.
Correct. Well, so far, that's what we've found. The schools clearly have below state average performance on state tests and graduation rates, yet they're not shut down or selected for non-reauthorization when the schools are required to renew their charters.
And so when you brought your findings to state regulators, what did they say?
We haven't gotten much response from state regulators yet. I haven't received a response yet from Tom Torlakson, the superintendent of public instruction. I haven't received any response from State Board of Education President Michael Kirst.
And parents, what are they saying about this?
I've heard from some parents who say, your reporting reflects our experience. We had a tough time and, you know, our struggles are described in your story. And I've heard from other parents who say online schooling was a perfect fit for my child. And the reason it worked was I chose as a parent to be very involved in the education process and I made sure that my students succeed.
So I wonder, though, if what you're saying there is this is a problem with online education in general for younger students in K through 12, rather than college or graduate level, that it's not necessarily the fault of this company per se that the students are learning, but the fault of the model in general.
So we included some research in our stories that was done by Credo, an organization affiliated with Stanford University, and that research was looking at online charter school students across the country and their ability to succeed in school. And the study found that on average, online charter school students are behind their peers in both math and reading. And a separate study that was done by a research group called Mathematica found that part of the reason students struggle is the lack of requirement for live, what's called synchronous participation and attendance.
So it seems like it's two separate issues that we're talking about here. One is the efficacy of online education in general for younger students, and then this particular company, which seems to be skirting charity regulations or nonprofit regulations.
Yes, that's right. I'm not sure that they're skirting the rules. Our investigation found that they're taking advantage of the rules, and that's based on a review of numerous financial and tax records.
Jessica Calafati is Capitol correspondent for the Mercury News. We reached out to California Virtual Academies. Their statements call the stories inaccurate and incompletely researched, but do not refute most of the reported facts. Well, are your children in an online school? How does it work for them? Leave us a message online on our Facebook page, KCW Press Play. Coming up, Sport Chalet is going out of business. We'll find out why the Southern California-based company could not compete with Lululemon or Target. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program Morning Becomes Eclectic can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Sports Chalet! We'll take you to the limit.
USC students singing the catchy jingle for Sports Chalet. Well, the sporting goods store has finally reached its limit. After 57 years, it is going out of business. Back in 1959, Norbert Olbers and his wife Irene purchased what was then a ski and tennis shop in La Cañada, Flint Ridge. It became Sports Chalet, and the couple catered to skiers and later scuba divers and surfers as those sports became popular. Well, 2 years ago, Sports Chalet was bought by Vestas Retail Group, and it is this group that will be closing all 47 Sports Chalet stores. Exercise may be hard, but selling exercise equipment may be even harder. Joining me now to explain Short Sports Chalet's demise is John Horan, publisher of Sporting Goods Intelligence. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you, Marilyn?
Great, thanks. So in March, Sports Chalet Authority was filed for bankruptcy, right? And now Sports Chalet is closing its doors.
And let's not leave out PacSun.
Okay, let's not. So it appears to be difficult. You don't have to have sport in your name for it to be difficult to be a sporting goods retailer.
Well, we have been overstored, and so we're sort of seeing the Piper come to, Piper getting paid on that score right now. And I think that's been going on for quite some time. Most retail categories don't have two or three or four major chains, operating nationally. They have one or at most two.
Hmm.
And so we're really kind of going through the process right now of catching up with a lot of the rest of the market. Certainly the fact that that we've had a pretty tough holiday season pushed a lot of the weaker companies over the edge. The sports category index is pretty high in terms of the number of people who have migrated to shopping online relative to brick and mortar.
Yeah.
So that's a factor. I mean, there are a lot of factors at
right.
work, but the big one is really that we had just too many stores.
Too many stores. And yet here in Southern California, this is the mecca for, you would think, for sporting goods. People are really into working out. It's usually good weather. So, and Sports Chalet seemed to be okay for many, many years. So,
Sports Chalet is, when Vestas brought it was practically bankrupt. I mean, it was, they bought it for nothing. So Sports Chalet has struggled for years. If you go back, I'm sure some of your listeners will remember Chex Sports, and there were actually two kind of regional guys out here, Chex and Sports Chalet. When Dick's came into the Southern California market, they needed to come in with some real estate because their formula kind of calls for a clustering of stores that they can, at the time they wanted to do a lot of circular advertising. So you want to amortize your advertising costs over a number of different stores. And so they were looking for somebody to buy and they decided to buy Chicks instead of Sports Chalet. But, had they bought Sports Chalet, we might be sitting here today talking about Chicks.
Okay. Well, what about the rise in athleisure? People are buying more workout clothes just to wear around, not necessarily to work out in. So why didn't that help them?
Well, it does help them. But, I think that one of the things that's kind of unique about the sporting goods business is that it's a very brand-driven business. And, what you really need more than anything is allocations of the really good stuff and lots of it from the really key brands like Nike and Under Armour and Adidas and people like that. And the fact is that Dick's has is getting the first and probably the second and third bite of the apple on that, because they do a really good job, and the brands like the way they present their product at retail and their full price retailers, and so they were really very favored by their vendor partners, and that played a big role in I think who really had the firepower to compete in the marketplace.
And then you have places like Lululemon selling $100 yoga pants.
Well, but that's a little different customer, really, mm-hmm. than the Sport Chalet customer. I mean, there's some overlap, obviously. And Lululemon has been a terrific success. I mean, I think that the secret sauce at Lululemon is that they, for the first time, created a female-friendly shopping environment, with a sports flavor to it. Women are a lot more comfortable buying a sports bra at Lululemon than they are at Dick's.
That would make sense, yes. So is that really the case, that sporting goods stores are seen as male-centric? A bunch of fishing tackle?
Well, it depends on the store. We're not sort of one size fits all. Some do a relatively good job with women, and others are a lot more challenged. Most bait shops are not really very female friendly places, but there are some retailers that do a pretty good job of catering to women. They all try. I mean, they all see that. You know what you're talking about with this athleisure thing. I mean, it's been critical. You know, the jeans people are struggling because women are wearing leggings now, and that's played right into the hands of the sports people, and in fact the jeans people. You know, you see people like stores like Gap opening up chains like Athleta, which are built on that look.
Right, and then you can get your basketball or what have you at Target.
Your basketball, you can't get branded. The Target's not really a factor in this, because Target's not getting the branded. They don't sell Nike, they don't sell Under Armour, they don't sell any of that kind of thing, and that's really what drives the business. So Target's really kind of off in a different different sector of the market.
So what accounts for the success of a place like REI then?
Well, they're a specialist. They really know the outdoor business, and they've done a great job of building up a customer base. The co-op thing, I think, helps them with a customer who's probably naturally a little more inclined to be a sort of let's give back to the environment and that kind of thing, which REI does. I mean, that's part of their marketing, and also part of their it's not just marketing to them, it's actually something they really believe in. So and REI is a very, very smart merchant. They've opened up part of the reason that Vestas is struggling is that some of the other chains, EMS being a main competitor, is facing a lot more competition in the East Coast from REI, because REI opened up a distribution center in Western Pennsylvania about 7 years ago to support the East Coast stores. And that's really made a huge difference.
Okay, so if we want to get our sporting goods here in Southern California, where should we go? Dick's?
Well, you're going to end up going to Dick's, I'm pretty sure, because there's going to be an auction of the Sports Authority leashes in a few weeks. And, the only two real players out there that would buy them as sporting goods stores, and not all of them will be sold as sporting goods stores, but there's a chain in Houston called Academy Sports and Outdoors, which is very big and very successful, and then there's Dick's. And Dick's has also got a DC in Arizona, which could support the California stores. They're already in the market. And California is not an easy place, in terms of development and things like that. So, buying a lot of those Sports Authority leases is going to put Dick's in a very, very strong position in the California market. They're going to have the logistical support, and they're going to have the real estate. So I'm sure that the shareholders of Dick's are they're going to go through a few rocky weeks and months here as they liquidate the TSA stores. But then after that, they're going to be in pretty good shape.
They'll be pretty happy. All right. John Horan, publisher of Sporting Goods Intelligence. Thanks.
Thank you.
Coming up on the show, local author Viet Thanh Nguyen just won a Pulitzer for his novel, The Sympathizer. It's about a Vietnamese man with divided loyalties after the war.
The tragedy that he confronts is not that he has to choose between what is right and wrong, but he has to choose between right and right.
A conversation with Viet Thanh Nguyen, that's coming up next on Press Play.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune download podcast to receive a free song of the day. Find Today's Top Tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brandt. Viet Thanh Nguyen just won this year's Pulitzer Prize for fiction for his novel, The Sympathizer. Unlike almost all other American books or films about the Vietnam War, The Sympathizer's main characters are Vietnamese. But the book's protagonist is not clearly defined. He's half Vietnamese, half European. He's been educated in Southern California, and he's a double agent. Nguyen himself was 4 years old when Saigon fell. His family escaped and came to the United States as refugees in 1975. He was raised here, and today Nguyen is a professor of English and American Studies and Ethnicity at USC. I spoke with him when the book came out last year, and I began by asking him how much of the story in The Sympathizer is his story.
Actually, very little of it is my story. It's not autobiographical in any way. I wanted to have a character who was in the middle of history, in the middle of politics, in the middle of all these traumatic times where people had to make really difficult decisions. And, you know, I was 4 years old when I left the country, so I didn't have to do any of those kinds of things. And my autobiography is really uninteresting. So I wanted to have a character who was my alter ego, who could say the things that I was thinking about, but who wasn't me.
But what about your family? Because your family actually, you know, has a pretty dramatic story in terms of leaving Vietnam after the fall of Saigon.
My family is very apolitical. They're anti-communist, but besides that, they are mostly hardcore Catholics and devoted business people. That's the background of my parents. And so they didn't want to get involved in any of these types of military or political activities. And their major strategy during the period of the war was survival, which was heroic enough given everything that they went through from, you know, the famine of the 1940s that killed a million people in northern Vietnam where they were. My mom recalls, you know, dead people on her doorstep at that time. And then they were refugees in 1954 when the country was divided. They fled south. And then they were forced to flee again in 1975 when the Vietnam War ended. So they do actually have a very dramatic life story with many ups and downs. Some of that does make its way into the novel when I talk broadly about what happened to Vietnamese refugees overall. But I'm glad to say that I was able to imagine most of this novel as a fiction, which nevertheless draws on the emotions and the experiences of many people that I knew.
And the main character, you don't name him.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you name him?
I think of him, number one, as a kind of everyman. He's everywhere in the history of this time, seeing all kinds of terrible and wonderful things. And he's also, the experiences that he undergoes are very specific to the Vietnam War and to his dilemma as a Eurasian and a double agent and a communist spy. But the basic choice that he confronts, I think, is a universal one. The choice that he confronts is, what is to be done? He lives in historical times. He feels he must do something about the calamities that he witnesses. And the tragedy that he confronts is not that he has to choose between what is right and wrong, but he has to choose between right and right. And for me, that was really what was tragic about this war, that it was being fought by people who had tremendous passions and beliefs, and all the sides felt they were doing the right thing.
He has to make difficult choices every day, though, mm-hmm. your character, because he is living a lie. He is pretending to be an ally of the United States on the South Vietnamese side, but he's actually, his heart is with the North Vietnamese, and he's a spy for them. And then after the fall of Saigon, he comes to the United States with the general who he's been working for, also not named.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got to keep pretending that he's on the general's side as the general decides to go and try to lead some kind of insurrection mm-hmm. back home.
Mm-hmm. Much of that is actually based on reality, on real historical events. You know, I grew up in the Vietnamese community in San Jose as a little boy, and we would go to the New Year celebrations, and I would see these exhibits featuring these guys in ragged camouflage uniforms somewhere in Thailand. And the request was for the community to raise funds to help these guys stage an effort to take back the country. So that was always on my mind. You know, growing up in the community, there were all these stories about how the war really hadn't ended for so many people. They were still traumatized. They had left people behind, you know, people they knew had been killed and so on. And the most literal manifestation of that was this persistent feeling that we were all anti-communists. We were still fighting the war. Americans wanted to put the war behind them, but we could not. And that's partly what the book wants to convey through this plot of a small band of devoted fanatics who still want to continue fighting the war.
And but what does that say in terms of assimilation and in terms of, I guess, the divided feelings that I assume many refugees from Vietnam felt, that here they were, refugees in a country that they had been fighting alongside at home, and then once they came here, they were treated as outsiders.
Well, one aspect of the Vietnamese American community that's pretty well known is that some portion of us are extremely successful. You know, my brother, for example, came at 11 years old, and by 18, he was valedictorian and was going to Harvard. And now he's on a White House committee. He chairs a White House committee. So this type of story is very well known, right? And that's the kind of story that Vietnamese Americans themselves want to put forth. But beneath that, it's much more complicated. I know a lot of Vietnamese people, especially of the older generation who lived through this war, who lost everything, who have not assimilated, who feel on the one hand grateful to America for having rescued them, and on the other hand feel rather bitter that America abandoned them. But they can say their gratitude out loud in the United States, but they don't want to express their bitterness or their attachment to the past. Instead, they save those feelings for Vietnamese inside the Vietnamese-American community, which is in turmoil still in many ways because of the events of the war.
Still.
For example, you know, in a densely populated Vietnamese-American community like in San Jose, my hometown, or in Orange County, the heart of Little Saigon, if you do anything that some people perceive to be sympathetic to communism, even open to establishing relationships with Vietnam in any way, you're likely to get marked as a communist yourself and be protested, red-baited, basically. And so these anti-communist feelings are still very strong for some parts of the Vietnamese-American community.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Viet Thanh Nguyen. He has a new novel out. It's called The Sympathizer. And part of the book, he becomes a consultant to a film director. You also don't give him a name. He's called The Auteur. And he's making a movie in Vietnam. And I'm wondering if you could read a passage when he's just met the auteur and has some suggestions for him in terms of how he should portray the Vietnamese.
Sure. And this section of the novel is based on my reactions to all the Hollywood war movies that I had seen in the 1980s where Americans got to win the war that they had actually lost. So anyway, he reads the screenplay and he's outraged by what he has read. "Even so," I said, "do you not think it would be a little more believable, a little more realistic, a little more authentic for a movie set in a certain country, for the people in that country to have something to say, instead of having your screenplay direct, as it does now, cut to villagers speaking in their own language? Do you think it might not be decent to let them actually say something instead of simply acknowledging that there is some kind of sound coming from their mouths? Could you not even just have them speak a heavily accented English? You know what I mean. Ching Chong English. Just to pretend they are speaking in an Asian language that somehow American audiences can strangely understand. And don't you think it would be more compelling if your Green Beret had a love interest? Do these men only love and die for each other? That is the implication without a woman in the midst." The auteur grimaced and said, "Very interesting. Great stuff. Loved it, but I had a question." "What was it?" "Oh, yes. How many movies have you made?" "None." "Isn't that right?" "None. Zero. Zilch. Nada. Nothing. And however you say it in your language. So thank you for telling me how to do my job. Now get the hell out of my house and come back after you've made a movie or two. Maybe then I'll listen to one or two of your cheap ideas."
And then he has a change of heart.
The auteur does have a change of heart. He feels like he does need to have a consultant for authenticity for his movie. So he invites our narrator to go with him to the Philippines for 7 months of black comedic highlights, hilarious experiences.
So this is maybe not even a thinly veiled critique of Apocalypse Now.
That's certainly the inspiration. No, I mean, Apocalypse Now is a great movie. It's a great work of art. But the difficulty I have with that movie is that the only place for someone like me in that movie is to be killed. So I saw that movie when I was about 10 years old on the VCR, and it traumatized me deeply. And even years later, when I would describe that movie to other people, my voice would shake. I would be gripped by rage, by this feeling that the only place for me in American culture was to be the gook. And so, to some extent, this novel is my revenge on Hollywood, not just Francis Ford Coppola, but all of Hollywood, all of the American culture industry, for the distorted stories that it has told about Vietnam and the Vietnamese people.
Why do you think it's taken so long to get the side of the story?
I think it's because Vietnamese Americans have to tell their own story. I think Americans are interested, but Americans aren't going to tell those kinds of stories, and Americans are going to tell the kinds of stories that they naturally gravitate towards, which are stories about Americans. And unfortunately, that kind of ethnocentrism, where Americans only want to hear stories about themselves, repeats the same kind of logic that helped to get Americans into Vietnam in the first place without understanding what they were getting themselves involved with.
Now, your main character, as I said, he doesn't have a name. He's also not fully Vietnamese. He's called the Bastard. Mm-hmm. And that is a mark of shame mm-hmm. because he's not fully Vietnamese. Why did you make him not fully Vietnamese?
Well, he's a man between cultures. He's a man between beliefs and ideologies. He's a man divided. And I wanted to pick a character in that case who whose background itself would symbolize that. You know, there were many Eurasians and many Amerasians in Vietnam who were produced as a result of French colonization and American intervention in Vietnam. So this is a real historical population that has been treated very badly. And their experiences do represent, in many ways, this idea that East and West never shall meet. So that is part of his tragedy, part of his dilemma, but it's also what gives him the capacity to see things from more than one side. And that's a major theme in the novel. His one talent, he says, is that he can see things from both sides. He can sympathize with every side involved in this conflict. But that ability to be sympathetic is also going to be his downfall. I think for many Vietnamese and many Americans, they have a hard time confronting what it is that their countries have done and what it is that their relatives have done. They know that their fathers and brothers went to war. They think of them as heroes, but they don't want to confront what they might have had to do in the line of duty. And in his case, because of his capacity for insight and sympathy, he's able to recognize that he is both human and inhuman. He is both capable of great human feeling for those he loves and even for his enemies, but he's also capable of doing these really regrettable things.
But he's also writing to someone who's reading his confession. This is a big confession. He's imprisoned and he's confessing. So I was always wondering, is he telling me the truth? Is he a reliable narrator? Is he being honest with us, and is he being honest with himself?
He's trying to be honest with himself. And obviously, I think he is an unreliable narrator because this confession is being extracted from him under great duress. So part of the narrative is his continual efforts to reassure us and his confessor that he is being honest. But of course, we need to take that with a huge grain of salt.
And so then are you also saying we have to take all the narratives that we tell ourselves about this war and about our motivations and about what happened and who won and who lost with a grain of salt as well?
Absolutely. This novel is a critique of how Americans have told stories about the Vietnam War, but it's also a critique of how Vietnamese people in Vietnam, the communists, have seen this war, and how Vietnamese Americans, Vietnamese refugees here have seen this war in a particular way that flatters themselves. So it's really equal opportunity criticism of this tendency that we all share to think of ourselves in the most positive fashion and to focus on our own victimization and to forget about the terrible things that we have done. And so he tries his best to look beyond his own victimization, to look beyond his own story, but it's an open question about whether any of us can actually do that.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in today.
And thank you.
That's Viet Thanh Nguyen. He's written a new novel. It's called The Sympathizer.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. Stay up to date on all of KCRW's music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. There are 1.5 million Filipino people here in California, but the food of the Philippines is not nearly as ubiquitous as other Asian cuisines like Chinese, Japanese, Korean. However, that seems to be changing nowadays. Filipino dishes recently appeared on LA menus, and it's becoming more trendy. Catherine Spires is a food writer and host of the podcast How It Got in Your Mouth. She's here now to tell us more about Filipino food. Hi.
Hi.
I like the alliteration there. Filipino food. What is it?
So it is actually kind of a mixture of various different cuisines. Of course, there's native Filipino food, but they've had so many people coming through that it also has a lot of Spanish influence. It has a lot of Chinese influence, and it even has some North American influence in it, too. So it's an excellent mashup.
So it's a combination of all these different cultures.
Yeah.
What's the overall flavor sense here, the flavor palette of this cuisine?
There's a little bit of bitter. There's a lot of sour. It's very vinegary. And that's why it can be a little bit of a challenge to some people. For instance, a really popular snack in the Philippines is unripe mango spread with fermented shrimp paste. So something that might be a brand new idea to a lot of people.
I'm puckering just thinking about it.
Yeah.
So not necessarily spicy.
No. It's really, spicy doesn't have a whole lot to do with it. I mean, the cuisine varies a little bit by the various islands throughout the Philippines, but spicy generally doesn't have as much to do with it. It's definitely more savory.
Well, Filipino culture has been with us for a long, long time. So are you surprised that it's just now kind of seeping out into the mainstream?
Yeah, Filipinos and Filipino Americans are one of the largest Asian American groups in California, but their cuisine hasn't hit popular culture the way that the other ones have. And I don't exactly know why it's been this year, but it's great that it is. It's always good to be introduced to this amazing new cuisine.
So what are some typical dishes?
Well, there's sort of like three or four dishes that are great intros to Filipino food. One of them is lumpia, which is their version of the spring roll. So it's, you know, deep fried and delicious. Mm-hmm. There's adobo, which is so key to Filipino food. And that is usually pork, sometimes chicken. And it's cooked in this mixture of vinegar, bay leaves, garlic, and salt and pepper, which sounds so simple. But oh my gosh, it is amazing.
So it's like a stew?
Yeah, it's just the meat and the sauce, and then they serve it over rice.
And a lot of Filipino food I've seen is in buffet form.
Yeah, I don't really know why that is, but that's true. That's called turo-turo, which means like to point at, sort of. And it's just, I think it's because Filipino food is sort of always served family style and restaurants aren't as much a part of the culture as it necessarily is in other countries. So if you go out to dinner, oftentimes it's getting buffet food, oftentimes to bring back home.
Is dessert a big part of Filipino food?
Mm-hmm, it sure is, yeah. And there's one dessert in particular. It's called halo-halo. And it is this big, enormous ice cream dish, and it's filled with shaved ice and milk and sugar, sometimes ice cream, but more importantly, it has like purple yam and plantains and red beans and tapioca, amazing different colors and textures in one big bowl.
Mm, yeah. Sounds so good.
It is.
I've seen something similar in Koreatown.
Yeah.
Korean
yeah.
ice cream shops.
It's a more Asian-style dessert.
Yeah, where you share a big bowl
yeah.
of it. And then you want more.
Yeah.
Okay. So I understand that Filipino dishes have popped up on some menus in trendy restaurants now.
Yeah. It's reached this critical point right now. They're serving it at Republique for brunch. They have an adobo fried rice. There is this new restaurant downtown, newish, called Rice Bar. And it's rice bowls, but you can choose from different types of rice all grown in the Philippines, which is kind of a cool idea.
How is the rice different?
There's black rice, there's red rice, there's brown rice. They have various different flavor profiles. And then you top it with different Filipino dishes. And then in Chinatown, there's a pop-up space called Unit 120. And there's a lot of different Filipino concepts going in right there. In fact, their sort of permanent lunch, weekday lunch concept is called Amboy. And that's Filipino food. And they have one dish in particular. It's all good, but there's one called chicken inasal. And that's grilled chicken with lime, pepper, and vinegar, and annatto. And again, those ingredients, it's all bold flavors.
You just said annatto?
Yeah.
What is that?
It's that orange. It's what makes macaroni and cheese orange.
Really?
Yeah. It has this sort of umami
flavor.
That was
flavor. Just some dye.
Well, they've actually switched it back, and now it's natural and not own craft, but yeah.
Oh, interesting. So where is this place? It's in Chinatown, but where exactly?
In the Far East Plaza.
Okay.
That center
of everything.
So
it's near Chago. It's near Pok
Pok. Yeah, all the cool places.
Scoops ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So one thing I think, I didn't know this, but the tiki cocktail has Filipino origins?
Well, yeah. So tiki culture started in Los Angeles, and the guy who started it just hired a bunch of Filipino bartenders. So there's a strong, like, Filipino tiki connection there. And some of the restaurant owners that I spoke to said that they enjoy going to Tiki Tea because they feel like it's sort of an extension of Filipino culture.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So what is your favorite Filipino restaurant?
Amboy has a lot of interesting stuff going on right now, and that's really basic, and things are served in a banana leaf for takeaway. It's kind of an interesting, fun
idea.
This
is the one in the Far East Plaza.
Yeah. And then Rice Bar. It's such an interesting concept, the idea of different rice, because, you know, we've learned that we all know that there's different types of wine and there's different types of chocolate, and it can be, you know, that same snobbery we can extend to rice now, which is great.
Well, anything, is anything free from that these days?
No, not at all.
Okay. We'll be like talking about ice cubes.
Right.
Artisanal ice cubes soon enough. Catherine Spires, food writer and host of the podcast, How It Got in Your Mouth. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Julie Myers.
Hello.
Here with the listener feedback.
That sounded
speaking
like a
of eating.
Portlandia. Episode.
Artisanal ice cubes.
Yeah, if you see it on there, you can demand royalties. Hear that,
you.
Fred Armisen?
Exactly.
Carrie Brownstein. So today on the show, we aired an interview with the Pulitzer Prize winner for fiction this year. And Darianne loved the interview, and she said that it reminded her of the importance of telling her own story, which is something that he said is important to do. If you want to be reflected in the world, sometimes you're going to have to do it yourself. Another listener chimed in about a story we did about California Virtual Academy. Mm-hmm. Her son actually went to one of these things, or, you know, stayed home and did it. It's an online thing.
Right.
She says he actually did very well, but she always wondered about the accountability. It seemed like there wasn't any if the parent was not willing to step in. But she says that it did put him on the path to doing well. He's in a private school now and doing very well. She wonders about the kids who are falling through the cracks there. Perhaps they were falling through the cracks already.
Well, the reporter did say you need a strong parental presence for these students to succeed.
Well, so luckily for Cairo, she was
there.
Yep.
All right. Thank you, Jolie Myers. If you want to weigh in on anything, please do. Our Twitter is @KCRW Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.